Hey, welcome to Off the Chain with Dave and Steele, where we talk about everything that's off the chain in American culture. This week, we've got a segment I like to call Small Talk. Now, Steele, are you good? Are you comfortable just like walking around the room, talking to people, like whoever?
I think those are two different questions. So I'm definitely comfortable talking to people about whatever, but whether I'm good at small talk, I would probably say no. I feel like this is something I kind of struggle with where I'm like, do people really like me? Or they just think this is weird guy just talking about crazy. I feel like sometimes in the room, I'm sort of, you remember that Debbie Downer character?
Yes.
Where everybody's talking about upbeat stuff, and then she's like, well, don't forget about AIDS. Wah, wah. That's like me in almost every situation I'm in. I'm like, yeah, let's bring in something really depressing and complicated. So small talk I could improve.
My mother-in-law, basically any activity that I've just done, she has a story about someone that's died doing that activity. So like, we'll come home from a concert and she's just babysat for us. And she's like, yeah, last week a guy came home from a concert and then he died. Like, oh no.
Morbid mother-in-law. That's awesome.
Yeah. So small talk. So this segment is to help us with our small talk. I'm not good at it. Back when I went to college, I came up with a strategy, Steele. I would have at least three anecdotes in my mind that I could bring up at any time with anybody that were like pretty universally interesting and entertaining almost to anyone. And it worked really well. Like, people in college would think I was really intelligent or interesting or funny. And it's just because I had three anecdotes like ready to go in any situation. If I wasn't armed, like, I'd just walk into a room and be like, hey, that's all I would have. I'm empty. I gotta be ready.
People think you're kind of a caveman.
So and you want them to think you're smart. You want people to think, hey, that guy knows what's going on. So that's the point of this segment, small talk. We're going to share some different interesting things that may help you in a situation where you don't know what to say. Just bring this up and people are like, that guy's cool. Steele, you brought a couple articles in. What do you want to bring up first?
Well, the first thing that I read this week that just captivated me, this was from The Guardian. It's an English newspaper. And the title of the article was called, Is Reading on the Loo Bad for You? I mean, a poet there. But the loo is the toilet. So there was a couple of people who've been publishing some studies on the effect, harmful or otherwise, of reading on the toilet. And I just loved it.
I was able to look through it as well. I am a toilet reader. I've read many books, many magazines. I've invested. Mostly I've read science fiction on the toilet. It just feels like it's an appropriate place for science fiction.
Yeah, so here's one of the takeaway quotes. I'm a toilet reader myself, but this is from Val Curtis, who's the director of the Hygiene Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She herself is a toilet reader, but she says there is a theoretical risk to this activity. To be blunt, they write, bugs in your poo can get on your hands, be transferred to your reading material, and onto the hands of some other unfortunates. The risk is quite slim, though. As Curtis says, we don't need to get anal about it. No, but she says the important thing is to wash your hands with soap after using the loo to get the bugs off. But this other guy, Ron Shaul, he was more interested in the question of whether sitting and reading while you're on the toilet might be relaxing and help make things go better. So they were looking at the effect of reading on the toilet on constipation. And here's what they found. Toilet readers spend more time on the loo and consider themselves less constipated than non-toilet readers. But other measures of their defecation habits show the two groups hardly differ. Toilet readers do suffer more hemorrhoids, but the effect is negligible. So, big picture, you may be less constipated or feel less constipated. You'll spend a bit more quality time there with yourself in the toilet, but you might get hemorrhoids. That's the kind of takeaway.
But the point is, basically, it sounds like people that read on the toilet are more satisfied with their toileting experience. That's what matters. Like, when I put the book down at the end of whatever I'm doing, like, I'm like, that was satisfying.
Yeah, you weren't really thinking about expelling waste from your sphincter. You were thinking about the science fiction world you're in, and that's a plus. I would say.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to be in the world of my rectum. I want to be in Ring World. I was just in Ring World still on my last poop, and it was fantastic.
So I think that just proves how bad I am at small talk. Hey, let's talk about toilet habits. Do you have something to add to the mix?
We just saw the Super Bowl not long ago. There's a beautiful commercial from Coke, and it's just about happiness. But Pepsi, they sponsored the entire halftime. So Pepsi and Coke are always kind of going at it head to head. So I read this article recently where it's talking about this kind of head to head that Coke and Pepsi are having, and they've always had. In the 80s, Pepsi started doing these blind taste tests, and Pepsi won all the time. Hands down, Pepsi won. And they started gaining ground on Coke with this strategy. It freaked Coke out enough to where they made a new recipe. They did new Coke. Essentially, Pepsi was sweeter. And on a single taste, people thought, like, oh, the sweeter one's better. And so Coke changed everything they were doing. They added more sugar to their Coke. And it went very poorly. Everyone hated new Coke. They went back to Coke Classic. And even though Pepsi's winning these taste tests, Coke is way ahead of Pepsi in sales. So what's explaining it? Is it people don't care that something tastes better and they're still drinking Coke because the Coke commercials are better?
Yeah, brand loyalty. That's what it sounds like.
I don't think that's true still.
Tell me more.
The article goes on to talk about how the flavor of Coke, you don't just take one sip of a soda. You drink an entire soda. In America these days, we're drinking 32, 64-ounce soda. So over the life of the soda you're holding, Coke actually has a much more delicious flavor than Pepsi. The sweetness on first taste tastes better, but the full-bodied flavor of a Coke is actually a better flavor.
So we're talking about like a blind taste test is like first impressions, but what matters, you're saying, is the whole experience.
Yeah, just one sip of a soda doesn't really tell you if you like the soda or not.
Yeah, for me, one sip of the soda tells me I don't like it generally, but I guess everybody's different. You know, I can't think of any experience in my life where I've actually drunk a whole Coke or Pepsi, but maybe if I had, then I would prefer one. Is that un-American to say that?
You're such a weird guy, Steele. You love poetry, you play pickup soccer, and you don't drink soda. Yeah.
I'm a perfect foil for you on this show, aren't I?
This is why you're having trouble with the small talk. You're not walking into the gathering and picking up a Coke and sipping on it and walking around the room. You're walking in and you're like, hey, is there any water available? Or is there like some lemon I can spray into my water?
Yeah, I do like water, definitely. Yeah.
So recently, so I'm a nurse still. I work in the hospital. I do lots of interesting stuff, lots of terrible things. I get really involved with people's bowel movements, things like that. But one real interesting thing I've learned about recently is I've learned a little bit about open heart surgery. I've just taken care of a few patients with heart problems. And open heart surgery, it's awesome. Medical technology is real neat. If they establish that the chest pain is from a heart issue, which they can do through an EKG, they can see that your heart rhythm's kind of changed. So the heart's not getting sufficient oxygen. They'll take you to the cath lab. And the cath lab, they'll insert a catheter in through your groin, an artery in your groin. And they'll insert this catheter far enough up to where they can spray a dye through the vessels in your heart. And they'll take x-rays or they'll take pictures. And the pictures will show you where in the heart there's blockages. And if the blockages are too much, they know we got to call the surgeon. So years and years ago, these things are happening. Eventually, you're going to have a heart attack. You're just going to die. But medical science is so interesting. They can literally take pictures before the surgeon even opens you up. He knows exactly which vessels are having trouble and which ones need to be replaced. They're very precise with this open heart surgery. They'll crack open your sternum. They'll take a vein out of your leg and they'll slap that right on your heart and provide a different way for blood to flow through your heart to get to your heart. What a heart attack is when blood can't flow to your heart. It can't get sufficient oxygen and your heart just kind of gives out. That's where the chest pain's coming from because your heart's not getting oxygen. It's just real neat that now they have these very precise tests. They can do this cath lab. They spray the dye and they know exactly where the problem is. They crack you open. They give you new vessels. Your heart's got going again. In a matter of days, you're back on your feet. You're sewed back up. You're walking around and you can go home.
Wow. You know, my grandfather was a heart surgeon, heart and lung surgeon. He was an inventor.
Oh, I did not know that.
J.D. Mortensen with an E-N. He invented this thing called the IVOX machine. It was an internal heart and lung that was kind of a replacement for catastrophic failure when there was an iron lung kind of situation. It was inserted surgically, and it got some patents, and they went through some trials. It ended up not being, I think, a widely used surgical tool, but it had been very promising in tests, and he invested a bunch of time and energy and did a bunch of research on this stuff.
Do you got anything else?
Yeah. Okay, so I've got something for you, Dave. And this one's a little lighter than maybe open-heart surgery. But Mallory Ortberg, she's the editor of the website The Toast. She wrote a piece for The New Yorker last month where she pretended to be Ayn Rand, the libertarian novelist, reviewing children's movies. These are truly off the chain. Truly, truly off the chain. For example, this is Ayn Rand's review of Charlotte's Web. A farmer allows sentimental drawings by a bug to prevail over economic necessity and refuses to value his prize pig, Wilbur, by processing and selling him on the open market. Presumably, the pig still dies eventually, only without profiting his owners. The farmer's daughter, Fern, learns nothing except how to become an unsuccessful farmer. There is a rat in this movie. I quite liked the rat. He knew how to extract value from his environment. 2 stars. I love it. Just imagining Ayn Rand reviewing children's movies. So good.
I like the one that basically plays off that a little bit later. She reviews Babe, and she says, another pig farmer fails to do his job. 2 stars.
It's kind of a theme in these children movies. You got to kill the pig. The Little Mermaid one was quite nice. A young woman achieves all of her goals. She finds an object of value. In this case, a broad-chested brunette man, and sacrifices as much as she believes necessary, the ocean, talking, etc., in order to acquire him. 4 stars. Oh, man, acquiring a broad-chested brunette man. They should put that as the new tagline of all the Little Mermaid posters. That'd be great.
It is. That is every woman's dream, really, a broad-chested brunette man.
Yeah. Her review of Garfield I thought was really heartfelt, very sentimental. I liked this movie. Cats are inherently valuable animals. It makes sense that there should be a movie about a cat. I could demonstrate the objective value of a cat if I wanted to. 4 stars. Man, Ayn Rand should review all of our movies. That's
oh, my goodness.
I got a cousin who's a libertarian. They're the worst.
I went to a libertarian lecture a while ago about the Constitution. And you know what it eventually ends up with, the libertarian telling you every social program in the United States needs to be cut. And like, I raised my hand. I was like, hey, what about the poor people, essentially? And they're like, oh, the private sector will step in. Like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes sense.
We better not take it too far where the revolution will sink our podcast, our fledgling podcast.
Yeah, we don't want to attack them.
Listen, we're giving it away for free.
Cut down big government. I'm fine with that.
Let's keep it positive, though. So that's what I got for small talk this week. It's okay to read on the toilet. It feels better. Ayn Rand reviews children movies. And Coke versus Pepsi? Neither. That's my vote, but Dave says Coke. Is that a good recap?
It's got to be Coke. Get your hands on a vanilla Coke. I think it would change your feelings about soda beverages.
All right. I'll take it under advisement, Dave. My nurse recommended vanilla Coke.
I didn't do that under any nursing license still. That's just a personal preference. But still, we have a segment that we did the first time that some people gave us positive reviews for. And this is a game where I tell you a little bit about an action movie that I've recently seen. And you tell me what you think it is. You give me a plot. You give me basically what you would make this movie into.
That sounds great. I'm really an action movie connoisseur, so I'm sure I'll excel at this.
In the past 5 years, have you even seen one action movie still? Is that maybe one?
I saw the second Hobbit movie over the holidays on DVD.
Yeah, they have those on DVD now.
Yeah.
Well, this movie I saw in the theater, it came out a while ago, but I really enjoyed it. It's called Lockout, and I'm just going to give you a couple of the details, and I want you to go from there. Lockout, there's a space prison orbiting the Earth. The president's daughter is involved, and There's only one man that can save her. Go.
Okay, so Lockout's your basic space prison thriller, but with a couple of twists. It starts off, we've got International Space Station, operated, of course, under Russian authority. You've got several cosmonauts who are seen in the opening scene, like they're installing it, putting on the finishing touches, and then you see the premiere. He comes on and he's this dirty, unshaved, Russian, filthy beast. And he's, send the prisoners to Cosmonaut Space Station. And he gives this fiery speech about how they're going to send the scum of Russia, which you know are like the world scum, up to this space station.
Oh, yeah.
So they get the first shipment. They put him on this like creaky old Russian spaceship, send him up there. And they're locked in, and they had the workers put the final bolts in. And they're like, this is a great triumph for Russian science. We have prisoners in space. Cannot harm, no escape, nothing. So, I mean, it's a big deal in Russia. Russia's really upset because the president has been trying to liberalize trade. He's been trying to, you know, take on some of these Russian oligarchs and these oil barons. There's a bunch of corruption. And the president's good friend is upset. And so what they do is they say, they're going to pull a fast one on the president. And so the Russian ambassador, who's gained the trust of the president, explains to the president that the Russians have just built, as a gesture of goodwill, an international space station that's meant to harmonize world communication. They want to be able to beam internet signals for free to the developing world, and the United States should get involved. And they really want this to be a positive PR experience.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And so the ambassador convinces the president it's a good idea, and he says, we need somebody to go represent the United States at this unveiling. We'd like them to travel to space to be there to help flip the switch that turns on the internet for poor people. We'll have a Russian. We'll have an American. They'll shake hands. And we'd really like it to be someone who represents the younger generation. And the president's like, well, of course. My daughter, as it happens, is a recent graduate of Stanford Tech School. She's a young person, really interested in third world development. I would love to send my daughter up to go flip the switch that turns on the internet for the world. So he says, we're going to put her on this space shuttle. We're going to send her up to the International Space Station where all the prisoners are. But he doesn't know that it's prisoners. He thinks it's this great photo op. They put her on the space shuttle. They send her up to the Russian cosmonaut prison station. And then once she gets there, the prisoners take her hostage, and she realizes the grim truth. And that's act one.
So hold on a minute. Basically, in your film, the Russians, they're pretty evil. Like, this is straight Cold War stuff, right?
I mean, that's the impression that you get from the first half of the film, for sure.
They're dirty. They're tricking the president into sending his daughter there.
Penal colony. Yeah.
So she's in trouble. She's with Russian prisoners.
Russian gangsters.
It doesn't get much worse than that.
And here's the other thing. The Russians sabotaged her spaceship so that it couldn't return. She's stuck there. And they've been jamming the signal so you can't track it with satellites. So it's out there in space somewhere, but it's very difficult, if not impossible, to know its exact coordinates.
Yes, it's cloaked. It's a cloaked station. Yeah. Wow.
They cloaked it. I forgot that word, but that was the word they used in the film. It's been cloaked. Yeah. So you said only one man can save her. And it's true. There was only one man the president could send. And that one man was Steve Guttenberg. You remember him from Three Men and a Little Lady?
I remember him. Police Academy movies.
Yeah, he was in those as well. Yeah. So yeah, he's the one guy that they have to send. And I guess the president had seen him in Police Academy and thought he'd be a good negotiator. He really represented law and order, and he knows how to fix stuff. And so he is also on the side, an amateur scientist in his home lab. He has what he thinks is an experimental solution that will override Russian cloaking devices in space. I mean, he hasn't ever tested it, but he thinks the technology is sound. So in kind of a madcap roundabout way, he pulls the wool over some NASA scientist's eyes. He commandeers a space-age super-fast rocket. And he kind of patches his homemade technology in, and he temporarily overrides the cloaking device and lands his rocket successfully on the Russian space penal colony where the president's daughter is being held hostage.
So he is now at the penal colony.
Yeah, he's definitely on the penal colony.
Okay. Yes, I'm totally with you. I'm on board.
And so he improvises. He's using like a blowtorch and a couple of other tools he just picks up. He kind of breaks the Russian seal, gets in, and then what he has to do is he has to pass as a Russian prisoner. So he shaves his head. He does this little thing with makeup where he puts like bags under his eyes, some stubble and stuff because he's been in space for a while. And so he's calling everyone comrade. You know, and so that's the comic relief moment.
Yeah. Comrades. Is he doing the Russian accent as well that you were doing earlier?
Yeah, he's like, comrades, where's the canteen? And they're like, canteen? What canteen? This Russia prison, no canteen. And so, you know, it goes like that for a while. But in the end, I don't want to spoil it for people, but I mean, the ending will blow you away. Lockout. I definitely recommend it. Russian space thriller, Steve Guttenberg. President's Daughter was played by Miley Cyrus, I think it was. I'm not good on the teen actors, but yeah.
Yeah, she did a great job. I'm glad that Guttenberg finally has his comeback vehicle, because since Three Men and a Little Lady, we haven't heard from him.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, IMDb is kind of a blank spot. I think he took some time off actually to work on the technology in the film. I believe that was actually a real part of the movie. He actually did build a Russian D-space cloaker, and so he was doing that for a while.
This has been like a pet project of Steve for quite some time.
Yeah, he helped write the script. I mean, he's a bit of a Renaissance man. So was I pretty close? So I mean, that was the film, right?
That essentially was the film. Like, I don't even know if we need to talk about the real film, because that was really good.
Okay, thanks.
You know, I'm going to tell you about the real film just a little bit, because it's real good. Essentially the same thing, except this is a space prison. They've been experimenting on the prisoners.
Bad movie.
Like, doing, like, weird mental stuff to them. The president's daughter's going there to figure out if they've really experimented on these space prisoners. She's trying to figure out, like, it's a humanitarian mission. She's the daughter from the show 24. So she's up on the prison, and she gets kidnapped by the prisoners. There's only one man that can save her. I'll give you his name, because it's good. He only goes by one name. Snow.
Snow. Agent Snow.
He was an agent, but he's been wrongly convicted of some crime. But he's the only guy that has the skills, that can ride the rocket and do all the stuff to get out of there. And so they go and they talk to him and they say, Snow, we'll give you a full pardon if you go up there. And he says in like a tough action guy voice, no way, I'm not going up there. And so he eventually gets up there. He's got amazing one-liners throughout the entire film. And of course, there's one scene where they fall through some section of the space station and she lands on top of him in kind of a provocative way. Sparks are kind of flying and he makes some type of sarcastic comment like, I didn't know you were into this sort of thing.
Or something. Well, I thought he was going to be like, a couple more of those, honey, and you'd start to melt this snow. Because you got to use something like disparaging. He has to call her like honey or something to make her know that like he's really in control, and to him she's just a woman kind of thing.
But he ends up killing like all the prisoners, and he saves her, and it's fantastic. And it was made for like $20 million, so all the special effects are like, you know, like video game quality or lower, like not very good. It's off the chain.
Wait, so this seems kind of like a raw deal. These prisoners get experimented on and then get murdered.
Yeah, I felt very sympathetic towards them in the end. And actually, the two main bad guy prisoners were Scottish, I believe. So they, you know, like the kilts and the tattoos and like were Scots and stuff.
They have kilts in space.
I don't think so, but it doesn't seem like they should have. I don't know.
Yeah, if gravity goes out, you get yourself flashed without asking. I mean, that's a dangerous proposition.
I'm sure they're comfortable with it. But that's Lockout. I'd recommend it to anyone, and I would definitely recommend filming a version of what you just laid out, Steele. That was terrific.
Yeah, let's pitch it. See if Steve's interested. I'm sure he's busy. His research is completed.
I think Steve's on board. That goes without saying. Like, Steve's ready. The last time I saw Steve, he was on a TV show that I was watching. He ended up being accused of being a pedophile on the show, and was convicted.
Wow. How the mighty have fallen.
I mean, it was just on the show. I'm not saying anything about Steve's actual life, but on the show, he was doing some unsavory things.
That's not good. Come on, Steve.
So do we want to answer some questions?
Let's take an ask off the chain. This one's pretty good.
Okay.
So this one is from Jan S. from Delafield, Wisconsin. She writes, is soda really that bad for you? I mean, come on.
Oh,
Steelman. We were talking about Pepsi Coke. I think she was a little up in arms about that last time.
So soda is delicious. I think that we all can agree on that except for Steel. Dr. Pepper, probably my favorite beverage on earth.
I've never had it, Dave.
Never had a Dr. Pepper?
Nope.
Oh, it's just got a good refreshing cola flavor that I think you'd love. I think you really should just try a sip. But on the other hand, soda is terrible for you. That's all people will drink, is they'll drink these sugary beverages. That's like it. And you'll go into their house and they'll just have 12-pack upon 12-pack of soda, or they'll have like Gatorade because they'll think that Gatorade is healthier because it's not carbonated. And there's literally many, many people I've met that the only beverage they're drinking is one of these sugary beverages.
Wow. Why?
They taste good, I guess. Okay. And people, water, you have to be used to the taste of water. If you just drink soda all the time and all of a sudden you're drinking a water, it's like, I don't want this. Why would I drink water when I have a Dr. Pepper right there and a Gatorade?
But your saliva, the thing that comes inside of your mouth, is made of water. That would be the most natural taste there is, I would think.
But your taste buds don't get used. This is literally my own experience. Like I've drank a lot of soda and crap like that in my life. I don't drink as much now, but now I can handle water. I drink water quite a bit. But there's people that all they do are drink soda, and it's terrible for you. It's all empty calories. When you're drinking the soda, you're getting so much calorie intake and literally zero nutrients. It's like you're having your whole meal in just a can, but then you're going to eat your meal as well.
Yikes. So soda is really that bad for you, Jan. I'm sorry. Maybe you should switch to water. Thanks for the question, though. Here's another question for you. This is from Mark in Chicago. I recently really messed up on a report that I had to turn in at work. I work for a large capital firm. I turned it in late. It was incomplete, and it was almost incomprehensible. What can I do to get my boss to think that I'm off the chain?
Okay. This goes back to our first segment that we did in this show.
Yeah.
You may not be doing your work correctly, so you want your boss to think you're intelligent, funny, and kind of the life of the meeting.
Right.
So you need to go into the meeting, order the lunch. You need to be ready to dominate the lunch with your anecdotes. You want them funny and interesting. You want to think about them beforehand. You go into the meeting already knowing how you're going to kill it. And this has nothing to do with work. You just want your boss to think this guy's interesting.
Because then he'll keep you around. He's like, the report may have sucked, but there's something in that guy.
The report may have sucked, but what he said about Pepsi and Coke, like, that really stuck with me.
I mean, that's insight.
Let's see what else he has.
Yeah. Maybe we just gave him the wrong topic for the report. If we had given him a topic of sufficient complexity to engage his, you know, powerful mind, we could have really got the best out of him. So it's like a challenge for the boss. The boss is like, how can I give this guy work that's worthy of the man? Rather than like, your report was incoherent and incomplete. Just, that's great advice, Dave. That's off the chain.
Mark, you just digest information, listen to podcasts, read stuff, so you're ready to make your boss think you're more intelligent than you are. Yeah. Do it.
All right, Dave. Thanks for the ask off the chain segment. That was a big, big success last week. If you have questions for off the chain, please send them in. You visit the website and send us your real life questions from real life people, and we'll answer them on the air. This week, Dave, I got an Unchained melody for you. You're going to love it. I'm going to play the first 10 seconds of this song, and you're going to tell me what you think of, okay? So that's a guitar lick right at the start of that song. What did you think of?
I thought of Back to the Future, Michael J. Fox performing at his parents' dance. That's what I thought.
Exactly. And then the guy calls him up. He's like, hey, Chuck, this is your cousin Marvin Berry. You got to listen to this guy. He's tearing it up, right? And then Michael J. Fox plays this exact clip. Are you ready? So recognizable, right? That's the opening 10 seconds from Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode. That's what this song makes me think of. This is a guy named Benjamin Booker. He's from Virginia, but he's based out of New Orleans. He's a 25-year-old guy, great guitarist, really lots of energy, pretty raucous. And the song that I'm going to play for this week is called Violent Shiver. I'm just going to play that opening little check there again, and we'll hear this Chuck Berry echo here. It's a really nice track. If you had a volume switch on your thing, you probably wanted to turn that one up to 11. That was pretty great. That's Benjamin Booker, Violent Shiver. He's signed to ATO Records, I think. He's put out one record. It's called Benjamin Booker. That's my Unchained Melody for this week.
I just have one song for you. This is a 90s flashback. I think it's good to go back in time every once in a while, back to our roots still. Did you ever listen to the rock group Pavement back?
Oh, man.
Younger.
Did I? I love Stephen Malkmus.
I love Pavement. I discovered them probably when I was like 16, 17, and then they broke up, and I never got to see them. So I've seen Stephen Malkmus a couple times, but this has got to be one of my favorite Pavement songs. It's called Gold Sounds. If you've never heard it, it's the best 90s indie rock that there could be. It's terrific.
Go back to those gold sounds and keep my
Dave, I can't listen to Pavement without just a great visual of you dancing. We need to get a video of Dave's dance moves up on our blog for this. I mean, man. Okay, so off the chain for sure. Why Gold Sounds?
It's fun. And I'm not always a lyrics guy, but Stephen Malkmus usually has very clever lyrics. There's a line in the song that I just love. It's so drunk in the August sun, and you're the kind of girl I like because you're empty. And I'm empty too. Yeah, it's so much fun. And his voice isn't very good. They weren't even very skilled on the guitar or drums or anything at this time. It's just these guys going in, and a lot of the lyrics he comes up with are just improvised, and he's going to replace them at some point, and he just never does because they're so good. He just comes up with them off the top of his head, and he just goes with it. It's so cool.
Yeah, I think it's got that very loose feeling, you know, where it's like the drum's a little bit off the beat, the guitar's a little out of tune. Malkmus sort of seems a little kind of surferish, like maybe not always there, but always there, you know? Yeah, I like that. The track that I wanted to add to that is kind of a more recent thing. Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks is his band now, I think. And this is No One Is As IRB, which is a great little, again, a lyrical gem.
Can bend the rules with primitive tools and stutters. I feel right at home beside the woodshed. Give as good as I do get. And I heart the part when you
right. So yeah, I mean, the way less energetic or aggressive on the, it's kind of just a guy and his guitar, but that same kind of lyrical intensity, the same kind of intelligence there.
I just like, he's very playful with what he does. And back when they were Pavement, like, you know, they didn't, keeping time wasn't all that important. And I like that because I can't keep time. If I'm supposed to clap along with the group, like I can't do it. So I like that on some of these songs, you just can't do it because it's a little goofy.
So Pavement, they're the band for people with poor motor skills. All right, everybody, get into it. Oh, that's great. I really like that. Those are great choices here. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. Do you have one more for us?
Actually, as I think about it, when we were thinking of Stephen Malkmus, the kind of sound that it makes me think of, there's a band now called Foxygen. Have you heard of these guys?
Yeah, I know them.
Yeah, so Foxygen's got that same kind of sound, that same kind of off-kilter. There's a great song, No Destruction, that I really like.
I do. I like those guys, too. I enjoy them. And they kind of have that same sort of little bit of playfulness, little
Definitely.
Bit of playfulness.
Tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think the last thing we want to share this week is Book Wisdom.
Yeah, let me hear you.
Okay, Dave, so Book Wisdom for this week, this is one of my favorite books of my life. My mom had this as a when she was a child in both English and French. It's a children's classic. It's called The Little Prince. So it's by a guy named Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. He was a French pilot and an adventurer, a really interesting guy. But in this book, there's a prince. He's like a little kid that's crash-landed on an alien planet, and he's met a fox. The fox is teaching him about what the word taming means, and he says that to tame means to establish ties. And the fox says to him, "To you, I'm nothing more than a fox like 100,000 other foxes. But if you tame me, then we shall need each other. To me, you will be unique in all of the world. To you, I shall be unique in all the world." And then he sends him off to look at these roses, because the prince has a rose that he loves on his home planet. And then the prince sees these roses, and he tells the roses that they're beautiful, but they're empty, because you don't have anyone that's tamed you, and you haven't tamed anyone. So he goes and says that, and he goes back to the fox. And the fox says, "Goodbye. And now here is my secret, a very simple secret. It's only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. What is essential is invisible to the eye," the little prince repeats, so that he would be sure to remember. "It is the time you have wasted for your rose that makes your rose so important. It's the time that I have wasted for my rose," said the little prince, so he would be sure to remember. "Men have forgotten this truth," said the fox, "but you must not forget it. You become responsible forever for what you have tamed. You are responsible for your rose." "I am responsible for my rose," the little prince repeated, so that he would be sure to remember. That's the end of this chapter that I love. It's this message about taming and responsibility and how we come to love the things that we give care to and that we spend time with.
To me, I was just thinking of relationships. I was thinking of how there's certain hospitals I enjoy going to work at because I have a real relationship with those coworkers. Or how we're thinking of moving in a few months, and it's fun, it's exciting to think of moving, but it's also scary because you have your relationships, you have your foundation, you have your friendships where you are, and lots of people don't like to move precisely because of that. Like they're comfortable where they're at, and they have their relationships, they've established, they've tamed their roses.
Yeah, I'm with you, Dave. I think it's about a relationship to people, about to the earth. I think about parenthood a lot when I think of that story because it's a children's story, but it's also about like the kind of relationship, like how your children, their sound of their voice is different to you than the sound of other children's voice, the sound of their laughter, changing their diapers feels different than changing a stranger's diaper, et cetera. I imagine as a nurse, you probably experienced that one.
Yeah, changing a toddler's diaper is way more pleasant than changing a grown man's diaper. I'll tell you that. Oh, boy.
Anyway, that's all I got for today, Dave. Anything you want to go out on? Last message for our off-the-chain listeners.
Just go out there, find what's off the chain, and share it with people. You want people to think you're smart and interesting? Then you got to tell them you're smart and interesting.
I love it, Dave. And I love you, man. Thanks a lot.
Off the chain.